Hey everybody, I want to give you a gift before we dive in. If you're at the beginning of your content marketing journey, or if you've been doing it a while, but it's not working as well as you want and you feel like something is missing, I want to give you a roadmap to help you get more ROI out of your content. This is my blog remix method, and it's a shortcut to go from one blog to dozens of pieces of content in less than 60 minutes. Even if you have webinars, podcasts, and video content, you can take the transcripts and follow the guidelines in the exact same way. It's a great resource. It's free. You should have it. If you haven't downloaded it already, grab it right now at justinsimon.co/remix. If you're listening to the podcast feed, you can click the link right below and download it. Get it, read it, apply it. It takes you step by step to get more value out of your blog content and get it in front of your audience. So grab the guide, get a blog, and get it running. That's my blog remix method, and it's free at justinsimon.co/remix. Hey everybody, before we get started, I wanna thank my friends at Hatch for producing this episode. You can get unlimited podcast editing and strategy for one flat rate by visiting hatch.fm. All right, let's get in the show. Welcome to Distribution First, the show where we flip content marketing on its head and focus on what happens after you hit publish. Each week, I share playbooks, motivations, stories, and strategies to help you repurpose and distribute your content because you deserve to get the most out of everything you create. Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Distribution First. Love having repeat guests, and today we've got Parthi from Letter Drop back again. If you didn't listen to his first episode, it was one of the most popular ones we did last year on really going deep dive on SEO, changes on all those things, and how you can do SEO better. But today we've got Parthi back, and we're going to talk all things employee advocacy. I have seen the good, the bad, the in-between. I've been a part of it, and now I'm advising clients on some of this stuff too. So super excited to have you on, Parthi.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me again. Like, first time I've been on a podcast for the second time. Excited.
Ooh, awesome. Yeah. It's one of my favorite things about running my own show is if I want to bring somebody back on and talk about something, I'm going to do it. So today's the day. So I guess from where we can start is like, and I know you've been at bigger orgs. Now, obviously, you're pulling your own sort of startup world here with a small, scrappy team, but kind of just curious, give us a lay of the land on where you're seeing with employee advocacy, how you've been able to build that out with your team and really from the outside looking in, made it a priority, probably in hiring discussions and things like that too. Like, you all have really hit the ground running.
Yeah, absolutely. And in all fairness, I think because of the nature of our business, we take employee advocacy very seriously because we have a product that enables it. But honestly, like, I'm just seeing so many companies out there that are successful with employee advocacy in whatever way that they manage to do it. And so you can think about the large companies which have historically done this. Think Gong, Apollo, Metadata. You can think about newer companies, ourselves, like Lavender, Hockey Stack, which are just truly surrounding their audience on LinkedIn. And so regardless of how you do it, the concept behind it is very sound. If your audience lives on LinkedIn, or honestly, like any channel, I think LinkedIn is the best channel just because you have all of this like firmographic information as well, and decision makers are on there. You can actually get in front of them by essentially getting your employees to authentically talk about your product, the problem you solve, just sort of like always be selling publicly online. And so that is the crux of employee advocacy. I think it is incredibly effective and also very important, especially as every channel is getting saturated right now, right? A lot of selling today is based on relationships. And so if you're just one of 100 cold emails that I open in my inbox every morning, one of 50 cold DMs on LinkedIn from like a stranger every day, or a cold call, the one way you can stand out is to make people come to you and have your brand be present and for people to passively learn about your company. And I think that's really where employee advocacy is starting to become incredibly important in this new go-to-market as channels get saturated.
Yeah. And for me, it's how do you consistently stay top of mind? And a brand just doing that on their own with a brand page can't do it. Certainly can't do it at the same scale and at the same level as a company who is doing it with multiple people. I think the interesting thing, Love that you said metadata, because we did do it right there for a while when I was at Metadata with Mark and Jason and everybody else.
It definitely stopped, I would say that.
And so the crew who was there at the time, but that, and I say that because being able to kind of pull the curtain back there, like that was a huge part of what we did. And it was actually baked into the strategy of, hey, this whole LinkedIn thing isn't just fun and games. It's not just like something to waste time on. It really was valuable to be able to do that. The balance for me always, Parthi, is, and I'm curious your take on this, because you said something about like having them do product and talk about things. What's the balance there for like, I mean, it makes sense, I think, especially for the folks on your team, it's part of the product. What you do is part of it. Like, it makes sense to talk about those things. How do you balance that when it's like, we make developer tools and I'm the content marketer and nobody's paying attention to me for developer tool things? What's the balance there with employee advocacy? How do you kind of think about that?
Yeah, I mean, in your specific example, like I think it would probably be a DevRel person, like a developer relationships person. They have to be able to like communicate with developers. But I think more broadly, the question you're asking is more so like, what happens if you feel uncomfortable being the voice of your company, essentially? Like you feel like, hey, look, I can't speak to this audience because I'm not one of them, is essentially kind of like what you're bringing up. And so I think with employee advocacy, number one thing is it is much more effective if one of the founders can actually portray that. It just makes sense. If a founder, a CEO is not willing to show up, it's very hard for the rest of the company to also do that. I'm not saying it's impossible. I actually don't know who the founders of Metadata are, but I know the entire marketing team at Metadata. I just want to point that out. So it doesn't have to be the founders. A great marketing team or a great whoever at the company who can speak to the audience can fill in that role. I would prefer if it were the founders, but if you're a marketer and you're just trying to hit pipeline goals, I want to just let you know that you can be empowered to fill in that gap. You don't have to wait for anybody's permission. Just do things, make things happen, make numbers move. And I'm sure your organization will reward you and also be like, wow, this actually works. Thank you for proving that to us. I think the second thing is, if you really feel uncomfortable about it, try to figure out who at your company you can turn into that kind of advocate. I would try to do it yourself, but also like figure out, okay, is there somebody at the company who has that right role or right title? And are they willing to do this? If you find yourself in a place where you can't find that person who wants to do it, I would try to do it yourself. And if you really feel like you're not in a good place, I don't know what to tell you. I feel like the organization is not set up or doesn't want to try this channel. It's just a lost opportunity for them. It's not that it won't work. It's more that like the organization doesn't want to do it. And I think that's a hard part to navigate. I think there's a whole conversation you should have in terms of opportunity costs and going to your CEO and talking about, like, if you are very serious about hitting pipeline goals, we will structurally make changes at this organization to maybe think about this as a channel.
That's a great point that I certainly don't think a founder or people who are unaware of the reality of kind of the landscape of the internet, and especially the B2B, how LinkedIn truly can play a role in that, and content, consistently putting content out can play a role in that. And how would you go about having that conversation with a founder? Like, they might not know, where do I begin to even think about that? If I'm a VP of marketing, I'm a content person talking to my VP, like, hey, there's real opportunity cost for you not doing this. And it's a truly legitimate channel, because my assumption would be most founders wouldn't think of it the same way as a paid ads program, a blogging program, an SEO, like a more traditional marketing function within a team where they're like, I'm just posting on LinkedIn. Like, what's that have to do with anything?
Absolutely. And I actually feel this problem fairly viscerally, because we sell to marketing organizations. And look, we sell across a whole suite of ways in which you can actually think about generating pipeline. So last time on this podcast, we talked about SEO quite a bit. This time we're talking about LinkedIn. And we tell our customers like, hey, the SEO stuff is going to help you with demand capture. But if you want to see results really quick, you need to actually start creating demand, doing demand gen. And I think the way for you to do that, especially if you think your buyer is on LinkedIn, and most decision makers are, you should start going hard on LinkedIn. Here's our playbook. We have like a playbook for you. Here's the tooling. Knock yourself out. We'll handhold you too. And you would be surprised by the number of people who are unwilling to actually take that advice.
I would not be surprised, Parthi.
Not surprised. And people are just unwilling to actually do it. And if I think about why, I think they kind of see it. They see us doing it. They see all these companies that we mentioned doing it. And I think it comes down to like being afraid to put their face behind something. I think there's an element of habit creation in here. It's hard in the same way that working out is hard or eating healthy is hard. There is an element of habit creation in here. And I think the last one to your point is I don't feel like I'm the right person to be able to talk about that, in which case I think you as a company have a bigger problem. Like if your marketing sales team feel uncomfortable talking about your product or problems that your customers face, like you have a larger problem than like tactics over here. And so I think those are like more structural, systematic issues that companies really need to address fundamentally before thinking about how do we do these things. Because tactics are not going to solve foundational issues in terms of like product marketing or just understanding like who you're selling to, how to reach them, and all that kind of stuff. And so my advice to somebody, if you want to have that conversation with your founder, first off, send them this podcast. Justin and I are talking about it. I can tell you that 64% of our inbound pipeline comes from LinkedIn. A large chunk of it is from my and the founder's LinkedIn, but we get our entire sales team doing it. Our BDRs, our AEs have a higher connect rate on LinkedIn. People want to follow them, want to connect with them because they show up as trusted voices in the ecosystem. Higher connect rate means more meetings booked, means they're hitting quota better. When our BDR cold calls somebody, they say like, hey, I've seen you guys on LinkedIn, or I've heard of you before, or like we connected 2 weeks ago and I've seen you in my feed before. Instead of hanging up and swearing at them, they actually want to have a conversation and be like, hey, shoot your shot. You have like 2 minutes, like tell me what you're about. And so there are all of these benefits that come from actually social selling that sort of grease your marketing sales go-to-market funnel. And I think you don't know it until you do it. And so I'd encourage every company, foundationally think about it. You need to make it a strategic initiative that has a little bit of buy-in and go do it for 6 months. The same way that you would say like, hey, I'm going to commit to like going to the gym 3 days a week for 6 months. If nothing happens, that's fine. I would be surprised if you don't see positive results. You start seeing source deals from LinkedIn. You start seeing larger pipeline, all the great stuff. And I think people should do it individually first, because if one person isn't willing to spearhead it, it's going to be very hard for you to like coordinate or like herd a bunch of cats to do it. So do it once, do it as an individual. If you're the one who's taking the initiative, make it work at some small scale and then expand it to the rest of your team once you can back it with numbers and say, look, I did this for 6 months. Look at the number of source leads we had from LinkedIn 6 months ago. Look at the number we have today. Look at all of the target ICP accounts that are visiting our website right now. And I put in UTM params to show that they're from LinkedIn. And look at all these people who are connected with me and now following with me who are all on our ICP list. And so I think if you can do that, you'll have a much better chance of building an employee advocacy program or a social selling program at your company. And that's going to take you very far against a competitor where like everything kind of sounds the same. Every product is largely the same. Now you have a brand and you have trust with real people who know what they're talking about. And that's going to help you outcompete them.
1,000%. There's so many things. My brain's going a million miles. You touched on a little bit, but as you sort of try to map that out, because this is what it's going to come down to, right? Proof. I need proof that like, is there a dashboard you're setting up? Is it simply just like you mentioned the UTM links? Is it something within the actual demo request form that you're like, how are you sort of tracking the overarch, especially as you build this out with more people and it gets a little bit more complex? Like, how are you sort of looking at it from a macro level? It'll be like, here's baselines, here's where we're at now.
Yeah. So sure, like track the vanity metrics, impressions, clicks, all that kind of stuff. But that's not the conversation you want to have with your CEO. They'll be like, cool, good for you. What you really want to think about is pipeline revenue. Every marketer in this macro environment needs to be thinking about this. I just need to double down on that. I'm still surprised by a number of people who are looking at vanity metrics. Easiest thing is if your PLG in your onboarding form asks, put in a, how did you hear about us? If you are sales led and you have a demo form, put in like, how do you hear about us? Leave it open-ended. Don't have a drop down, because if you have a drop down, people are just going to select the first option that they see. You're going to get bad data. Let them enter whatever they want to enter. We make it mandatory actually at LetterDrop, and it helps us figure out how to spend tens of thousands of dollars every month in terms of marketing. And so it's very important for us to actually know that. And I think it's short-sighted for people to be like, no, like we're going to not have that field. So that's the easiest free thing that you can do right now. The second thing I would do is there's a lot of solutions out there in terms of essentially just identifying traffic on your website. You can like get Clearbit or similar for free to get started. Just pick your favorite, drop one of them on your website. Start noticing the kinds of accounts that are coming in. If there's a correlation between the accounts that are liking, commenting on your posts and people who are coming to your website, that is a positive indication of where they're coming from. You're getting ICP traffic from social and from LinkedIn. And then the very last thing, and this is stuff that we work on, is trying to actually figure out, can we actually try help companies understand the content journey across LinkedIn to your website to back your CRM data in terms of close one pipeline? And that's something that we have built and we have. But I think that's like, if you want to go real, like once you've built this program out and you want to really get down to numbers, you could do that. But I think the first two solutions are free and you can get started with that literally just today.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's super helpful. And I think, like you said, that is key. The vanity metrics are fine. And I think in some regards, they can be useful for, especially as you're trying to like prove out growth or prove those things. And even more so, I think when you're trying to build the habit, right? Like it's much more rewarding to go to the gym when you step on the scale and you've lost 5 pounds. So you can see the leading indicators of things happening. You haven't lost it all, or you haven't gotten in super shape. You can't run a 5K yet, but we're making progress. Kind of gives you that want to go back and do it again. But yeah, being able to map that down and understand where traffic's coming from. And, you know, people ask me like, I mean, and again, for my business, it's so scaled back, but like same thing. I know when I'm having a conversation with somebody, I know where that thing started for the most part, or I can kind of quickly go figure out, right? Are they, you know, on the newsletter? Did they respond to it? Oh, okay. Yep. That makes sense. LinkedIn's very easy to see for me to see that through, but that's how you start to, and again, I don't have any fancy CRM, but it's built out in the CRM to understand like, where did this contact come from? Where did this lead come from? Where, and I would say 90% of them for me are even LinkedIn at this point. Like just, it's that powerful of a tool for people who are using it. Another thing I think that goes in with it, especially, and this was something that we experienced when we were at Metadata is, and I think you're probably kind of touching a similar vein as you're building it out with LetterDrop, is you don't need 50 people on the team doing this to make you feel so much bigger than you actually are. We probably had 2 people that were super consistent, 3 that were pretty consistent, 4 that were consistent enough, more consistent than average or average. And we still felt, you know, like, oh my gosh, like there's so much stuff going on here. Are you finding the same thing where it's like, it's just a few, you just need a few people who are willing and able to talk about these things over time?
Yeah, you don't need a big team to do this. Like our go-to-market team is 4 people, right? And so it's not like we're a large company, but people do say they feel our presence. They see us quite a bit on LinkedIn at the very least. I think we're not doing as nearly as well as some companies our size. And I think that's more of a matter of like nature of content, which we're trying to fix. But small team, you can actually get quite good results just by showing up a couple times a week and actually sharing something that's generally insightful, thoughtful, educational, and then promote your product or service in the mix as well. And the reason why is because the bar is so low. Like you're competing against nothing, essentially. The vast majority of companies are doing zit. And so if you even do something, like you will stand out right now. I think the easier thing to do is, or the low effort thing to do from the rest of your company is, if they don't want to actually be a brand themselves, the least that they can do is share it with their network. It's just like, that comment, and tools like us automate that as well. That also goes pretty darn far, because when people do that, their network starts seeing that content. And as long as their network is prospects or buyers, that works. So what you don't want to do, for example, is you sell to developers, get your engineering team engaging with this kind of stuff, for sure. If you sell to like HR people, getting your engineering team to like and comment probably isn't quite as effective. If anything, you're giving LinkedIn the wrong signals, telling them like, hey, like a bunch of engineers like this, I should show it to more engineers. What you need is connect people who are in your sales team, partnerships team, marketing team, who are connected with prospects, connected with partners. So, hey, like we have like a customer advisory board, and these are people who have influence in our industry. Those are people you want to engage with you. I think that's a way to get your sort of extended circle, your family around your company, to essentially help promote your content. But at its core, in terms of the actual voices, the producers, like a handful of people will go a very, very long way. So that's how I would structure it. Founder, and then maybe like a handful of people on sales, marketing, whoever it may be. And then broader reach is employees who have the right network And then broader reach beyond that is partners, investors, customers who have the right network. And that is how I would kind of like layer on LinkedIn employee or like partner advocacy, essentially.
Mm. I know LetterDrop lets you have the people come in from the org, like you can assign the people to be able to automatically engage and comment and things like that. Is it similar for like customer advocacy programs, or is there like a weird sort of, you know, you're not at our company, how do we add you in there? Or like, have you seen anybody think of doing it that way?
Yeah, we have a bunch of customers who do that. So for example, Signal Fire is a VC firm that works with us. And whenever they launch a new company, they want to make sure all the partners have, all the investors have a lot of great portfolio companies who could be customers. And so that's an example of non-employees or people essentially boosting stuff. We have other customers, companies like Warmly, for example, who essentially get their friends and partners to participate. And then they essentially give them different permissions. So some people can, you can post on their behalf, or some people you can like, comment on their behalf, and some people you can only like on their behalf. It depends on how comfortable they are with different levels of permissions. So you can set that out for an individual, just group them and say like, hey, here's my advisor list, here's my employee list, here's my sales team. And then for the right type of content, you can get the support from the people you need. That's all opt-in. They still have to authenticate into your LinkedIn account. So they are opting in, they see the permissions, and they can also choose to disconnect the app at any point in time if they're like, yeah, look, it's not something I want to do.
Yeah, that's cool though. I could even see it around, like you said, when they're launching or doing something, but like, hey, I've got this thing I'm launching. Are you willing to kind of help me do this even in a short-term period of, I'm just looking for your help, but I'll do it for you. Like, because I think that's one of the hard things too. And I'd be curious kind of getting your thoughts on that, as well as like, it's hard to get people to do things that aren't part of their daily job. I've even seen that like podcast, right? Like I have you come on, I can create a bunch of stuff for you, I can hand it over to you, and it can sit on a folder because it's just not, it's hard. You know what I mean? Like we've all been there and done that. And so how can we better arm folks to actually either know what's coming, like know what content's, I think it's a huge part is like, one of the struggles I always had at companies was, hey, I've got this new blog post. Oh, okay, cool. Like, what do I write? I feel like there's a lot of, you got to make it kind of almost a program in a lot of ways. Like, it's not, like you talked about, like, it's got to be embedded as a thing that we're doing, because otherwise it won't be successful if it's just like, oh, here's our boilerplate for, you know, new feature came out. We've all seen this on LinkedIn, probably like company comes out. It's all the same post all day long. Okay.
Yeah. Totally agree with you. And which is why, like, I think my view on this is almost like, don't rely on people. I mean, it's boring work. Nobody wants to do it. It's not part of their day-to-day job. If you can automate it, if you can let software do it, just let software do it. Let people focus on the things that they are good at, which is probably the initial insight, which becomes your content that you want to share. That's where people should be.
Mm.
What we want to do at the end stage, which is distributing stuff, like just making things happen, that's where it has to be as automated as possible. Because to your point, yeah, there's a lot of clips just sitting in folders out there. There's probably a lot of pipeline companies could be generating if they just took the effort to distribute that, redistribute that on a regular basis, on a regular cadence, just because our first podcast is still relevant today. There's nothing from that podcast that wouldn't be beneficial to somebody today. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be shared. And we do it. We have a lot of content. We do share it occasionally. But I think not enough companies think about it that way. They don't think about, here's an asset that is evergreen, and I just need to create the infrastructure in place to be able to get in front of my buyers on a consistent basis to stay top of mind until they're ready to actually have a conversation with me about a purchase.
I was doing a workshop with a company last month, and one of the things their team brought up was there's still a big disconnect, I think, for a lot of companies in terms of the push and pull strategy, as far as like the goal of my social content is to get you to come back to my bigger thing, and you must consume my bigger thing in order for me to check a box and be like, that was a successful content campaign. And I think it's a huge shift for folks to understand, like, the goal of creating this piece of content is not necessarily for you to consume all of it. The goal is so we can chop up on these ideas, get different things out there, and then I can, as a smart marketer, find the best pieces and then distribute those things out in front of the audience, because I want the audience to get the information. And so if I take this episode, and I think a huge part of distribution in 2024 is employee advocacy. So that's a huge thing that I should be talking about. It's obviously a huge thing that your company is going to be wanting to talk about. It's not necessarily like my goal is to get everybody to listen to this 30 to 40 minute podcast episode. The goal is, I bet if I get 10 clips out of this and I dripped 10 clips over the next 6 months, that's going to be pretty effective too. Now, I'm going to talk about employee advocacy probably way more than I normally would, because it's maybe not part of the everyday conversation that I'm having, but it is important.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I do think that a lot of people think about the base asset, your long blog post, your 40-minute podcast episode. And I think those assets are very important. Don't get me wrong. A person who is sufficiently motivated, who wants to learn about something, will go and do it. Guess what? That person is also like very much in the market to buy if they're willing to do that work. So don't get me wrong. Those assets matter. Ryan Law talks about this, like long form content isn't dying. We watch 3-hour long movies. All of these assets matter, but these assets are not easy to distribute, to your point. What you need to do is take these assets, make them easily consumable, and use those as essentially leads for people who are not quite ready to sit down. They might be in a couple of weeks. That's fine. In months, whatever, but nurturing them through that journey over many months or many weeks to get them to the point where, like, yes, I'm thinking about employee advocacy. I'm thinking about Justin. I'm thinking about Parthi. I'm thinking about distribution version. I'm thinking about letter drop. And I'm ready to go in, listen to that podcast, read that blog post, and actually think about it, because my CEO just told me today that we need to think about lowering our CAC. We need to think about new acquisition strategies, because what we're doing right now is not working. And that's where all of these consumable things come in. And to your point, I think more people need to start thinking about content from that perspective. It's a long-term game. And I think attribution is important, but attribution over a 6-month, 12-month period, not over like, lead clicked on my thing, went to the long form thing, signed up the demo request in a funnel on the same minute. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, in one fall swoop. They just did it all. Amazing. Yeah, no, it's interesting too. And I think for anybody who's, as you're building out this sort of employee advocacy structure at your team, or you're doing more LinkedIn posting on your own as a founder or however it is, like, there's also the reality of LinkedIn and how that platform works is like, your buyers are probably your lurkers. They may not be your commenters and even the people who like your stuff. So I think that can be true, but like, I've even seen that for me where there's people who I've never interacted with, literally never interacted with or seen on LinkedIn engaging with my stuff, who fill out the form, become a client, and say, I've just been listening to the podcast and been seeing your content for 6 months straight. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even know that you knew it existed. So amazing. So I think that's another thing to understand too, is like, it isn't that direct line. It's sort of like all of those things working together to then make the system run in the long run.
Happens all the time. Literally, we'll get inbound DMs from CMOs, from 500 employee companies, people who we would normally struggle to get in front of. Our BDR would struggle to get in front of like decision maker at that level. Inbound, they're like, oh yeah, I've just been following you on LinkedIn for the past 3 months. I like your stuff. Some initiative came up. I thought of you. Can you give this person on my team a demo? Happens all the time. And I don't think enough companies know that this is possible. And they're just sleeping on it.
And how much better of a conversation is that? That's one of the things when I've been talking to content teams as well, in terms of like, really the distribution, the repurposing, why do it? Why get your stuff out there? Like, it's a ton of work. We're already doing a bunch of other things. I don't have time for it. It's not a priority. The hardest thing in a lot of this is you're battling status quo, you know, whether it's the founders who need to post or, and they're not, or the teams who are doing things one way and doing another. But I think what you said right there is so key, which is you're priming the market. There's people who are not ready to buy. It's just, you know, it's the fact or whatever the stat is. 3% of the folks that you're engaging with are actually potentially ready to buy, and 97 aren't. And so of those 97% of people, it's your job to be the first person they think of when they're ready to solve that problem. And the trick with it now is the idea of being known, liked, and trusted. You can't be this nameless, faceless corporation and compete on features. For you, it's a like, oh, you know, I saw Zach, or oh, you know, I saw Parthi, or oh, you know, like when I was a meta, it was, you know, Mark and Jason and the podcast and, you know, even my stuff from time to time, like, that stuff really matters, because now it feels like when you hop on a call or when somebody else hops on a call, oh, man, I feel like we've talked before, or I feel like, gosh, it seems like we're connected in this way. And I saw something, I was reading a book the other day and they were talking about this. And the idea being that like your brain cannot decipher digital from real. And so like a human brain is like the connections are there regardless of whether, and obviously I think if you're in person and there's probably a different level to it, but like just at a baseline, like your brain is connecting you to these other people.
Totally true, which is why a lot of people feel closer to celebs or famous personalities than they are. They feel like they know it's this information asymmetry. I think you touched upon a very important point. You just mentioned Zach from our sales team. I've never talked to you about Zach. You've never met him.
Nope.
You know him.
Yep.
You mentioned Jason and Mark and all these people from Metadata who I've had the pleasure of meeting over the past like year or two. And none of you are at Metadata anymore. And so one of the pushbacks I see with these programs is people are like, I don't want to attach myself to my company's brand. I don't want to hurt my own brand. Guess what? A, if you're not doing anything, you probably don't have a brand to hurt in the first place. Two, it's viewed positively, right? If I'm a future employer and I look at that, I'm like, you could do that for your previous employer as a company. You're an asset. Make yourself more sellable. You are helping your company. It's just win-win for everybody. And I think we can point to that too. Like Metadata's organic presence has declined since like that cohort or marketing team has left the company. And all of you are doing great things at new places. Distribution First, Jason's own consulting shop, Mark at User Evidence. You're running the same playbooks at different places and doing so successfully. And so I want to just encourage every marketer out there to be like, if you can hit numbers for your company and run these employee advocacy programs for your business, you can technically do it anywhere. It is a skill you can take from company to company. Don't think of it as like tying yourself to a brand. The brand can change. I might start a new company in the future. Our people may not be in MarTech. Or people are going to be like, oh, Parthi's a MarTech guy. I was like, heck, I was a software engineer and a product manager 2 years ago. Like, I'm not a marketing person, but here I am. Now I am. And I can reinvent myself in a couple of years as well. And I think every individual, you can do that too, is what I would say if that is an objection in your head as to why you can't do this.
I think another objection that I was thinking of too, and I've heard this, is the flip side of that coin, which is like, why? And I feel like this is dying down a little bit, at least in like SaaS startup land, because I think they're starting to see like, that's kind of a silly point. But like, what if these people leave who are now they're the faces of my organization? What happens when, you know, in this case, let's say you've propped Zach up as this thing and now Zach leaves to another company and now what the heck, right? He was our guy and now he's somebody else. Like, how do you think about that? Or how would you maybe have that conversation with another founder who is sort of questioning like, should we really buy into this?
One, you as a founder should do it yourself. So you need a baseline, which is like, hey, like I'm with the company and I'm stuck with the company. And so this is our baseline. The second thing is you want at least a couple of employees to do this. We get our whole go-to-market team to do this. It's not just Zach, it's Ryan, it's Matt, it's Keelan, it's everybody. And anybody who joins our go-to-market team is going to be expected to do this as well. And they can get up to speed in a couple of months. It's not a big deal to get someone up to speed. We've done it already. We can do it again. Sure, there's a short-term hit where like your person, like in Metadata's case, like you guys left. There's no reason why they can't have done that with other people. And they still do have some people. Like I think like Rachel, for example, like I still see her on LinkedIn. They can build that program up again. And so in the same way that I think it's a transferable skill or a transferable thing for an individual, from a company's perspective, I think you can figure out how to like encourage employees and build this every time. That said, I would highly encourage the founders do it and have a little bit of a baseline there. I think a lot of very successful companies are able to do it with the founders. If you're not doing it with the founders, I would just say like it is completely possible to do that over and over again with new members of the marketing team. There's no reason why Metadata can't just prop up like, hey, look, here are new faces right now. And it's the same thing. It's customer education. Like I think your customers, at the end of the day, they care about their problems. Whether the face it's coming from changes every now and then is almost secondary.
Yeah. And I saw somebody talking about this the other day with YouTube. They were talking about how some companies are hesitant to prop somebody up to say, be the YouTube person on the team because if that person builds their own brand or leaves or something, now the face of the company is sort of gone. And the point they made was like, well, sure, what if you had an engineer who was a star engineer and they left? Of course, it's not at the front end, but you would try to find another great engineer. So your goal in that case would be to find another great person who could be in front of the camera and be that, you know? And so I think that's the same thing where it's like, to your point, these playbooks can be redone with different people and built out in different ways. I do think at the end of the day, it does come down to the founder. I'm curious before we wrap, because it's been in the back of my brain. For the founders, this is just not what they're going to do. They're not going to do it. What's your take on ghostwriting? Like, I feel like ghostwriters are booming everywhere. Like every founder, like, or multiple people kind of in my world, like solopreneurs, they're doing ghostwriting for founders. Is that a viable avenue for, you know, at least let's say if it's done really well? Do you see that as viable in case the founder's like, I'm not willing to write this content. I don't know what it is, but I'll have a conversation once a month and you can do it for me.
Absolutely. I think that is incredibly viable to have ghostwriting. Here's a little secret for the audience out there. Half of my content is not written by me.
Heyo.
Keelan, who's on our team, takes a lot of the core ideas we have on our blog, on our podcast, on our videos like this, where I have said something intelligent or smart. We've turned it into a long-form asset. She uses our Toolian platform to essentially repurpose them. We have a bunch of templates, which for like advice with strong hook or product launch or bullet points or whatever. We have a lot of templates. We pop them into LetterDrop, out comes something. She gets her 90% there. She edits it a little bit. And then she says, okay, this is going out on Parthi's LinkedIn next Tuesday in review. And I just like get an email in my inbox. I'm like, cool. I don't like this word or whatever. I'll change it. And goes out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is 50% of my LinkedIn content, quite honestly. And so I think ghostwriting is very viable. The catch is you do need the long form assets, or you need something sensible to say. I've put in the work at some point in time. I've had those thoughts or opinions or perspectives. We're just repurposing them at some point in the future. And so that's what makes the ghostwriting effective, is that they have a good source. And so if you ghostwrite and the person who's ghostwriting for you, how much ever that may be assisted with AI, if they don't have good source material, they don't actually understand the business, the customer, the problem, they will fail and you will get content that you are not proud of putting out on your LinkedIn. And so that would be my sort of a caveat or catch there, is you still need to have an opinion, perspective, and be able to educate your customers. Without that, it's the equivalent of like the SEO spammy articles, which make no sense, but on LinkedIn form, that's it.
It's interesting. Like, I've definitely done ghostwriting for people when I was in-house. I was that person. I've done that. And now I've actually worked with a couple of, I never thought about it like as ghostwriting, but I guess that's what it is. Like at the end of the day, working with them to, sometimes I do it for brands and sometimes that content is spun off and given to the founder or things like that. But it's why like hiring a good ghostwriter costs a decent chunk of change, or having somebody who's in your, on your team to learn that and spend time to do that, because it takes time to learn the audience, to learn what is going to matter, to learn the voice and tone of that founder. And obviously like the more you do it, the better it gets. But as somebody who's done that, having a piece of content that's really, really solid, you can get a lot of content. And that's what I think people don't quite understand, is this podcast for you, Parthi, like you'll get a lot of content out of this, or your team will get a lot of content out of this, 40, less than an hour to record. And so I think like for that time, the ROI is pretty, pretty high to be able to do something like that. And this is obviously an external thing, but even if you did that internally, and this was a Zoom call, and you just had a conversation for 30 minutes to an hour every month, you're pretty well set to be able to have a pretty good stream of content. And then I think tools like LetterDrop, other things like having a strategy, using the distribution first frameworks, why people are here and listening to this show, all of those things are how you scale yourself. It's how you get more done, be more efficient. We're in a wild transition where like there are groups of people who are stuck doing it the old way, and there are groups of people who are massively more efficient and being able to get way more done by using like proper strategy and proper tooling.
Absolutely. And I think to your point, you don't need a podcast. I mean, podcast is great. You can talk to another person, you can get share audiences, but you can just have an internal conversation with somebody who's a subject matter expert in your company and create lots of great content. And a lot of people don't want to do that initial bit of hard work, takes half an hour, but will have an outsized impact on everything else you can create.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like if you did one interview, and again, like whether you do it manually, whether you use a tool like LetterDrop, whether you do it in a different way, like that can become a blog post, which becomes LinkedIn content, which all fuels that thing to be able to get way more and to get those thoughts out in different perspectives as well. So this has been super great. Hopefully it's been a helpful episode for folks listening and trying to like get in on what the heck I should be doing from an employee advocacy standpoint. I think my biggest perspective and takeaway is if you don't have your founder on board, it's going to be tough, but there are ways around that. I think some of the ghostwriting stuff is a way around that. I think building the habit and starting on your own and then building out the proof of what that is. So I talk a lot about this with concept programs, doing pilots. So starting something and just doing, again, not saying you're going to run a marathon, but hey, I'm going to learn to run a 5K. It's a different animal in a whole different world, and it's a little bit more achievable. So those are my big takeaways. And Parthi, thanks for coming on, man. This has been great.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure coming on a second time.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, you know, 6 months from now, you come back and we'll chat about something else. So it'll be great. Thanks, Parthi.
Absolutely.
All right, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Distribution First, and thank you for listening all the way through. I appreciate you so, so much. And I hope you're able to apply what you learned in this episode one way or another into your content strategy as well. Speaking of strategy, we have a lot of things going on this year that are going to help you build your brand, 10x your content, and transform the way you do content marketing. Make sure to subscribe to the show and sign up for my newsletter at justinsimon.co so you don't miss a thing. I look forward to serving you in the next episode as well. And until then, take care, and I'll see you next time.